You're listening to Bit by Bit, July 18th, 2007. Hello and welcome. My name is Bob Sprankle, and I'm coming to you from Newton, Mass, down at the Building Learning's Community Conference with Alan November, and just having an incredible time. Today is the first day of the conference for me. It's Tuesday. There was some pre-conference stuff. I got here last night, and it's just so great. And what a charge. It's kind of surreal seeing all these people that I've been reading for years, you know, sitting at the same table in three dimensions instead of a flat two-dimensional screen. Have gone to some great workshops. I saw Darren, I saw Dean, and I saw Ewan. Dr. Tyson did the keynote today. Alan had the interview there, Alan November, and I'll be getting these podcasts up as soon as I can. We're going to start with Ewan McIntosh's podcast. That was the last conference I went to today, and I didn't blog the notes on that because David Jakes had set up a Skype cast, chat cast, where a bunch of us in the room added to the notes. So since I didn't blog about him, I thought I would give him the first run here for the podcast. And thanks to Ewan for this incredible talk that I want to hear again already. And thanks for letting me podcast it. So without further ado, Ewan McIntosh with Is Your Public Body Public?
Okay, shall we get going? Yes?
Yes.
Yep, for that? Okay, good stuff. Thank you very much for coming. It's amazing how people just have to flock you to electricity. There's a huge gathering at the back of the room. The antisocial electrified, the more sociable electrified down here. I hope we're going to have some difficult questions to answer over the next hour, and maybe some answers, but I hope that you do leave with more questions. I often get disappointed if I go to hear someone and leave agreeing with everything they said, because I like to be challenged and I like to come up with my own view. And given the international nature of this conference, I'd be disappointed if we didn't have lots and lots and lots of different views. Now, normally, one would start by saying, "My name is Ewan McIntosh, and I am." Because I am. No, it's not that. You would say I am, and you would give a job title or something like that. And this talk's all about how public our public bodies are. Whether that is a public body might be your classroom, it might be a school. Are there any people here in charge of several schools? Yeah, so it might be that scenario. It might be that you are an education minister or someone really important like that. But it's not that easy, because I'm going to do the thing that you should never do. I'm going to put up lots of text. Just pick one. Who am I? What do I do? And depending on who's paying my salary, my airline, my hotel bill, my bus fare, who happens to be in the room, who I think I should be pleasing, who I think I should be ignoring, who I'm trying to get on the good side of, who I'm really trying to annoy. I could use any one of these. I've got lots of different identities, and these are just the face-to-face, real-life ones that my wife actually understands. And then there's other stuff too. So the question that I'm asking here really is, how public is your public body? Yes. But when we introduce the word public, we also talk about private. And what I want to do is play these off each other today and really get under the skin of these issues, because I don't think we have properly. And I want to show you what we've done in one part of Scotland and then see what you can do with it. Now, there was an actress, and I can't remember who, I can't find it on Google, can't find it on Wikipedia. Maybe a film buff here can help me. We've tried, have we not? There was an actress who said, "I leave my public face in a jar at the door, and pick it up when I leave and put it back in when I return. And the thing about that was that, you know, she was famous, so she would go out with her public face on, but then when she was at home, she was a different person. I'm sure as teachers, I certainly felt it. You have your Mr. McIntosh face, and you have your You and My Love face, and you have all kinds of faces. And your public face and your private face, it's not just you, the teacher. Your colleagues, your students, parents, the politicians who make decisions about education, all of them have public and private faces. And it used to be nice and simple. You have two faces, and you could leave one at the door, and at least we could understand what the public face was. But even that's beginning to change because of the web. That now, instead of just public-private face, you could have any of these faces. And I have to tell you, this graphic actually fills that space about six times over. There's lots that's not there. Now, identity 2.0 is a horrible little phrase that's been coined, but it helps because it implies that there's a different kind of identity. But it also misleads because it makes you think that you're only talking about two identities. What I want to do is share some thoughts on spaces. And this is, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, these ideas, they've come from a lot of work that we've been doing at Channel 4, trying to work out how a public-private television company can connect better to its market of 14 to 26-year-olds. You try tapping into that market to get sexual education across to them, it's not easy. And Matt Locke, who I work with, came up with these explanations. I think they're brilliant. We have secret spaces. We've got our mobile phone, SMS, instant messenger. How many of you have sent a text message to a loved one today? You inconsiderate souls. Why didn't you phone them? How many of you have sent an instant message to one person today? Okay. You've had a secret conversation. Would you want to share it with us? Would you like to tell us what your little loving message was? Probably not, because it's a secret space. We then have group spaces. Bebo, which is the biggest kind of social network in Europe. Facebook, which I have become far too addicted to. Tagged, all these kind of sites. And they're group spaces because they are actually quite private. I'm very particular about who I invite to be a friend in Facebook. I'm not very particular about who I invite to be a friend in Bebo. I'll accept pretty much anyone in Bebo because I want to see what the difference is between the two. But Facebook, I actually have to have, you know, touched flesh and got to know you and know what you're like and know that you're not a psychopath to accept you into my fold on Facebook. It's a group space and we share stuff with our group. I think my group, I don't know how many are in my group. Maybe someone can look me up and find out. 160, I think, something like that, of people who apparently are my friends. And we're going to come back to whether can you be friends with 160 people. Publishing spaces, which I love. If you know me, you know that I love publishing stuff far too much. Don't know if it was a compliment last night or not when someone in the front row said, you sometimes, I just do control K, mark all as red, because it's too much. And on my public space, I'll put my photos, I'll blog my thoughts, I'll put up ideas and links, and I'm publishing it and I don't quite know who for. I'm publishing it really for me, but putting it out in a public space. I'm not publishing it on my group space because that would be a waste of my time and a waste of your time. I'm not putting it on a mobile text message because that would just be ridiculous. It would be a waste of everyone's time. Performing spaces. We have these too. This is a performing space right here, right now, which I'm not the most comfortable in. Second Life, World of Warcraft, these online virtual environments, online games. But performance spaces can be face-to-face in your school as well. And that takes me on to the next one, participation spaces. And I want you to think, is your school a performing space, a participation space? Is it a mixture between the two? Marches, meetings, markets, meeting lots of strangers, events like this, and getting to know them. That is what I would call the participation space. And it's a different attitude you've got when you're there as well, a different identity. And the very final one, watching spaces. Big Brother, television, gigs, concerts, going to the theatre, you're watching. Now, some of you are watching now. Some of you are making this a participation space. Some of you will be treating this as a performance space because you're going to ask questions later on and become part of this. Others might be keeping this a secret space by Skyping to a couple of people to talk. Some people might be turning this space into a group space and only sharing it through updates with their Twitter, or with even more groupy is their Facebook community. So they're only sharing it with 20, 30, 40, 160 people. And I think that's fascinating. Think about your classroom. Can your classroom really, at the moment, be all six of these spaces? Would you want it to be all six of these spaces at once? And what are the consequences of it being all six spaces at once? Is it a distraction or is it an extension? Now, this is another point, and this one courtesy of Dave Weinberger. I apologise if you've read Everything is Miscellaneous. Who has read Everything is Miscellaneous? It's not a video. Damn, I shouldn't have said that. I could have come over as original. Okay. He talks, it's a really nice point because it puts into words what I've been struggling to say for a while. How implicit or explicit is your digital life? What I mean by that, let's take a look at Spudgate. Okay? Spudgate's actually a superb writer. Her Bebo Space has got some excellent writing. If you were here this morning, you'd have read some of her writing. Who was here this morning? Yes, one person. Okay. So, good writing. Yeah?
Yeah.
Really good writing. Now, have you all been onto a public profile like this, a MySpace or a Bebo or a Facebook? If not, you can use Spudgid as your reference point. And she's got sort of, give them the old razzle-dazzle, razzle-dazzle on. She's 14, she's from Balbeggy, she was the Perth Academy, and she's now truly proud of it. I think I'm a lucky kid, it's totally weird to quote a certain someone, one day I'm going to be famous. Well, it's come. Second one, Things I Love. My Friends, Music Town, I don't know what that is. Laughing, Being Happy, France Trip 07, Bloody Awesome. Making Other People Feel Great About Themselves, Music Camps, Guys, Love, Dreams, Musicals, Romantic Comedy, Summer, Doctor Who, and lots, lots more. Things I Don't Love. Lies, Attention Seekers, People Who Don't Like You Just Because You Dress a Certain Way or Hang Around with Certain People. What's with that? Narrow-minded people, Users, Revision, Exams. Fakes, eggs, you get the idea. Gender, female. Okay. How explicit is that? How clear is it about what she likes? Pretty clear. What about all the stuff that she's not said though? Because we've all just made a snap judgment what that girl is like based on 50 words. I'm going to ask you to a little experiment. If you've got a piece of paper or if you've got your profile online, I'm going to give you a minute, okay, which is about as long as it takes to set up a profile on Bebo, on Facebook, something like that. If you've got a sheet of paper, if you don't, I'll give you paper. I'll give you an evaluation form and you can write the back of it. And I want you to write down your profile. I want you to write down things I love, things I don't love. You've got a minute to tell us explicitly who you are. Okay? Go for it. Do you want some music while you do this? I'll put on a bit. There's a blue. They're blue. They're there. I'm going to give you some. I'm going to give you some music. You've got 40 seconds left. British, you don't understand anything about that music.
That might be a good thing.
Okay, it's a wonderful programme called Countdown, which Channel 4 produced. There you go. Okay, I want you just to, can I have a volunteer? Come on, you've just pressed publish, you're all public. Let's go for it.
Things I love, solving problems, my husband, things I
thinking, math, teaching, and interacting. Things I don't love, rudeness, misunderstanding, and reading.
Okay, Bob, you read that online. What's she like as a person?
I was kind of thinking of my lines. What she's. I heard the love. I heard the love.
We have a passive
her her husband came third.
The husband did come through. Anyone who is listening, like to give me a quick summary of what she's like as a person? Would you go and meet this person for a coffee based on that interest? Any English teachers here? An English teacher? Would you go and meet her for a coffee? No. But I bet that if you two do go for a coffee, that you'll actually hit it off fine. Because you're both in the same conference, you're in the same room. You must share some kind of... There must be something implicit in there that brought you in the same room at the same time, the same place. And you come from thousands of miles apart. Do you see my point? There's a heck of a lot we don't include in our profile online. There's a heck of a lot we don't include in our classrooms when we're working with children, because we block a lot out. But the other thing is that when you're looking at your work, and when you're thinking about how public the work of your class is, or how public the work of your organisation, your school is, are you going to publish blog posts live? No pre-moderation. Are you going to let comments appear with no pre-moderation? Are you going to allow all the teachers in your authority to blog what they want, when they want, and not ever ask them to take a post off their blog? Now we're getting into tricky stuff. Because how implicit or explicit is your work is an even harder question. Write down what you do for a living. You've got 30 seconds. Teach math. A couple of things in it. First thing is, everyone thinks they know what teaching's about. Parents think they know what teaching's about because they went to school once, a long time ago, and that's what it must be like. Administrators and politicians who make big decisions know what it's like to be a teacher, either because they were one, a long time ago, or they were a student in a school, an even longer time ago. So he's been very explicit in saying teaching. He's very explicit in saying maths, but our understanding of what teaching and maths are depends entirely on experiences we had a long time ago. There's so much implicit that he's not telling us, because he's having to make explicit what it is he does, that we've actually jumped to the wrong conclusion. Do you see what I mean? I gave up maths at 16. I think you're a great guy and get on with you online, and we met first time last night, had a laugh. But I shouldn't, by all intents and purposes. Because first of all, teachers, I avoided being one for years. Because every one of my parents, grandparents and so on were teachers. I even went to join the army for a year to avoid being a teacher. And do you know what they said in the army? You'd be a wonderful teacher. Maths, I hated maths at school.
To my class.
Absolutely, but you didn't say that. You said, I teach maths. All of you would have, did everyone else use the word teach at some point? Maybe vast majority. The administrator, I'd love to find out what you said, because I haven't got a clue what an administrator does, and I guess most people here don't either, so do enlighten us. Which again, says very little about what you probably actually do, doesn't it? And I have trouble. What do you? Someone asked me, Bob.
What do you do?
I'm a new technologies research practitioner for learning and teaching Scotland. That wasn't even the accent. And it means nothing, does it?
Can you say it again?
A new technologies research practitioner. Yes, it's all right, but
what does that mean?
What does it mean? What do I actually do? What are my interactions with people? Why am I here? So, some really interesting questions to ask about how do you, I mean, all of you are going to go back from this conference and try and convince other people about something, yes? Mm-hmm. It'd be a bad conference if you didn't. And so what you've got to try and work out, what we've all got to try and work out, is how do you make explicit to people who weren't here all the cool stuff that you're feeling without losing it, and without making them turn their back in the way that I would turn my back on a math teacher normally. So I'm going to tell a little bit about me, try and make things a little bit more implicit. This is a good way of doing it because a video says 1,000 words. I live in Scotland, work with 45 schools in this part of Scotland, and you can see it's a beautiful part of Scotland as well. We've got places called Humbie. Humbie was a town designed for like a theme park, which has now got a school with 8 kids in it, and they have a cow in their playground, and they write a blog called Holly the Herefordshire. It's the type of cow, and the blog is like a learning log of what the cow's learned, written by the kids, really clever. And then we've got just for you, Darren, you know where people are over up here. Is where Robert Jones, the maths teacher who you hooked up with, that's where he works, down by the sea. We've got Preston Pans, which is an old coal mining area. I'm going to visit the old coal mines now, very deprived, drug problems, etc, etc. And you've got little places like Gifford, Garvold, and Bolton, and East Salton, and places like Aishelford. That's a wonderful name, it doesn't look anything like it sounds. So very varied landscape. The reason I'm showing you that, I'll explain in a second. Learning and teaching in Scotland, you actually pay the salary, if you like, are based in Glasgow. I don't really go to Glasgow much, but they are the curriculum authority, the kind of curriculum assessment type thing. We don't do assessment so much in summative terms. We do formative assessment. And we are based, this is the building site, they finished the building. We're not in a building site anymore. We're based in the centre of Glasgow. If you come in September to the Scottish Learning Festival, you're welcome to join us in the office for some free coffee. So, how implicit or explicit are you is the really difficult question, which I'm not going to make you answer now. I'm going to save that for the end. But what I want to share with you is that in that little place, East Lothian, when I started working with them on social media, gaming, trying to get them to change the way that they thought about teaching and learning, 20 teachers out of just over 1,000 kept a learning log online through a blog about what they got up to in their classroom. So 20, it's not much. What's maths teacher, 20 people out of 1,000 is how many percent?
Point two percent,
which is not exactly... No, it's not a rousing endorsement. And from that, the decision you should be drawing is, well, blogging is a waste of time for teachers because it's not bringing anything. It's too small a number. That wasn't my attitude, because I realised that explicit numbers like this mean naff all. So I worked hard with a team who worked incredibly hard. There's 2.5 of us in the team. Wait, it's not a half person who works part of the week. We now have about 350 of our educators, over a third of our educators share every week what they get up to in their classrooms. And about 800 managers, other teachers, parents, and some students blog about what they're learning, what they're understanding, and how they think things could be made better. Now, I'm going to talk tomorrow about how we did that. This is not about how we did that. But the interesting thing here is the only way we did that was by making a very distinct difference between what we could expect to be explicit and what we had to just assume was implicit. The assumption means that we had to trust in ourselves a heck of a lot. So I'm going to go through five elements, if you like, that if you're thinking about safety, privacy, whether things should be made public, whether we keep everything inside, whether we pre-moderate, post-moderate, don't moderate at all, these five things should help you come to a decision. And I'm not saying that the decision will be the same as ours, because you all come from different cultures and contexts. But hopefully they'll help you, and hopefully they'll give you some arguments to go back to your people with to help them understand better too. So the very first one, viral success cannot be planned. That was a viral success that we had. And for me to say, well, yes, we wrote a plan, we followed it every day, on time, we worked weekends if we got out of sync, and yes, we reached our target and exceeded it, that would be rubbish. This wasn't planned particularly. There was a loose framework, if you like, but it wasn't particularly well planned. The reason for that is people do things when they see new ideas. Who's read Blink by Malcolm Gladwell? Now, I apologise because you're going to be bored. But you'll be familiar with the concept of thin slicing. When I was about 8 or 9, we had the Pepsi Challenge, which I believe is American anyway. Did you have that? Yeah. So, big marketing thing. So I'd arrive at Glasgow Central Station, which you saw in the picture, as an excited 8-year-old coming to the big city, and they would have 2 little glasses on the table. You'd go, you'd... On the glasses would be about that much of black liquid coming from a tiny little town, which you visit, I can't believe it. One of the audience visited there quite once, twice? Just the one. I'll tell you a lot about the place. Coming from Dunoon and taking a sip of this black liquid that they called Coca-Cola or Pepsi, and you weren't sure which one it was, so you drink both. And then which one did about 90% of people prefer? 9 out of 10 people preferred Pepsi. Worldwide sales of Pepsi have never gone beyond 50% in comparison to Coca-Cola. Why? Well, if you try drinking a full can of Pepsi, yeah, it's disgusting. It's far too sweet. It's got too much saccharine. So it's okay in small portions and gives you that little buzz that you want. But then when you have to consume a whole can, it's sickly, it's too much, and you don't finish it. Coca-Cola, on the other hand, doesn't taste too good at first. It's spiky on your tongue, I would say. The stuff here is much sweeter than it is in Europe. But you've also got a lemony flavour in there, and it actually hurts when you drink it because it's very bubbly, much more carbonated water in it. But you can drink a whole can because it's quite interesting. It's not oversweet, and it goes really well with vodka. Another thing. So we can experiment later. Okay? But why am I telling you stories about Coca-Cola? Because when people come to conferences like this, you take a sip of something new, and then you decide that for the next 5 years you're going to plan everything around that technology, that piece of kit, that web app that someone shows you. And of course it doesn't work. You blog for 6 weeks and say, no one's reading it, and you shut it down. Anyone ever shut down a blog because no one was reading it? Liars. Believe me, a lot of people shut down their blogs after 3 months. Now, the other thing about thin slicing is that people can look at something new and exciting and think it's going to be too much hard work, I'm not going to have the time, or it's not applicable. And a big danger for me with the first talk I was giving this morning was I was really afraid it just wasn't going to apply to a lot of people's context, because it was about Scotland very specifically. And in the end, people said, yeah, I can see how we can take some of that. But that's what you're going to face. As long as you're aware of it, you can help coax people through. And it helps when you're making things explicit and people get turned off, that you know this is going on, you can start to try and reveal the implicit to them. Second thing people have is fear. They are afraid of anything new. Now, one of the best blogs I've ever read was the Bass Player's blog. You can Google it, look it up. Bass Player's blog is written by an educational expert aged 50 who wrote a post about what he thought this horrible thing, School 2.0, was. And he said, the only reason my teachers don't do cool stuff is because they're afraid of the cool stuff. They're afraid it won't work, that it wouldn't be educational, that we wouldn't pay attention, that we'll just go wild with it. My point is, yeah, you're going to be afraid trying new stuff out. You're going to be afraid doing something when someone's told you not to do it that way. What's the worst thing that can happen? What's the good situation? What's the good thing that could happen? My point is that don't loathe the fear. Love the fear. Embrace the fear. And try and explain through and get what you want thanks to it, and being able to empathise with how other people are afraid of what you're talking about. Final thing that we'll do is the overplan. How many of you, when you're using technology in a lesson, spend proportionately more time preparing than if you were just doing what I call a on-the-back-of-the-envelope plan? I do it because I want the technology lesson to be absolutely brilliant, to blow their minds away. I want it to work. Whereas some of the best lessons I've done have had no technology and have literally been planned and designed in the back of an envelope. When the technology breaks, you can have the best lessons ever. I mean, that's the point. Do you have room for serendipity in your programmes of work? Or are you so busy doing SATs and SET? What are these things? We don't do summative assessment until the age of 16 in Scotland. We don't do any formal testing until a child is 16 years old, because there's some learning to be done before then. So do you have room for serendipity? And also, are you allowed to fail? Are you allowed to make mistakes? And do you allow your students to make mistakes? Administrators, do you allow your teachers to make mistakes? Admit to it and sort it out? Or do you prevent people making mistakes? Mistakes are the most important thing we can do. We all know it. You've got Tim Dyson, who invented that Hoover, you know, the one with the centrifugal force, yeah? He came up with 5,721 patents, and only one of them was a success. All the rest were a failure. Yet, if he hadn't had all the failures, he would never have had the Dyson Hoover. Very, very final one. People say, why bother? And I bet we've all had this. Now, you were here this morning, so you don't mind seeing it again. You know what I'm talking about? Why bother? What's changed? 2007. Anyone who reads my blog who's done their homework will know the answer to this question. No pressure. Why is 2007 the most important year this millennium? And why do we have to really get our acting to get together now? Not next year, not the year after, now.
That's the year. The kids that are entering school now are the ones that were born when the internet was born.
He doesn't mark all his red. Great. 2007, if I rewind the clock a bit, back to 1991, how many of you have 16-year-old kids yourselves? Yeah? How many of you teach 16-year-old kids? Okay. And many of them will be leaving to go into further education, training, employment, or deciding to stay on at school. Or working in a hotel. And the thing about them is they are born the same year that the web was born, web browsing. And just think about their school experience. How have we leveraged the fact that these kids entering our world have only ever known the web? Gets better, folks. How many of you have 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds about to go into elementary school? Yep, or in the first year of elementary. 2001 is about the time we reached that tipping point for one-click publishing, where anyone could publish what they wanted in a click, no questions asked, no permission required. And yet we still live in this dream world that we can stop people publishing what they want. So 2001, these kids are now entering our school system. Some of us are doing stuff about it. Most of our colleagues still aren't. Something has changed. And I think something has to change now. Now. Not even 2008-9. It's this year that we have to start working really hard. We have a thing in Britain called the 2020 Vision. I don't know if you have a similar political hyperbole. The 2020 Vision leaves out an entire generation. We're going to leave out an entire generation and screw that one up so that we can come up with a nice poster that explains what our 2020 Vision is. I'm going to show you a video that explains. You've not seen this one, so you'll enjoy it. is that not cool?
Another thing is, if you know Alan November's son, is there not a passing resemblance? So, I think that's cool. And the first thing is, my father was a music teacher for 34 years. I showed him this. And it's the first time in a long time I've seen him actually get excited about something I've shown him. My family life, you can tell what it's like. So frustrating. That's why I love these conferences. I showed him, he said, "Dad, it's just, I mean, I don't know how he did it." So I said to my dad, I said, "Dad, you're 63 years old. You've got nothing to do with your days. Go and work out how to do it yourself. You've got a new MacBook Pro. You've got the camera. Go and try and do it. I'm not going to show you what he did because he didn't manage. He wasn't able to make it all sync up and get his rhythm on to make it all work at the same time, which made it even more impressive. Now that's one thing. I'm going to show you two more videos just because I can."
Super presents Emily Fox.
She's beaten the world record for cup stacking. Now, I'm going to show this to you again. You have to keep your mouth shut, okay? I want you to look at the mother in the background.
Super Hands presents.
The daughter's just won world record for cup
stacking. Emily Fox.
And if you looked at yourselves the first time you saw it, you were all exactly the same. Actually, Bob Spangler, who obviously stacks cups in his free time.
I will now.
Yeah. And that's an interesting thing. I do this with the... I show this video a heck of a lot. It was Stephen Heppel, an educational technologist, who showed it to me the first time. And when I saw this, I thought, I'm going to show this to as many people as I can. I've maybe shown it now to 2,000 people since January. And the best time was when we were in Channel 4 and we had a conference. Were you there? You were there, was that? You can tell the story, you jump in. But there were a bunch of media people, cool media types who wear jeans. And there were some serious teacherly types, like Tony. Serious decision-making people. There were some politician-type people as well. Former advisor to Tony Blair was there. And there were about 50 kids from suburban London. I have never seen a reaction like it, because what happened, we showed this, all the kids are going, "Woo! Woo!" Doing this thing that American teenagers do all the time, but you know, "Woo! Woo!" And rapturous applause, and all the media guys are going, "It's a bit grainy, isn't it?" So, do you see my point? That yeah. There's a point to be had here. Now, I thought that was good. I'm going to show you this. You talk about collaborative time's really good. B, it's the competition mat that gets me. So I went off, I did some research, and cup stacking is an international sport. They have all kinds of things. I stack cups really badly, but I do stack cups. Cupstacking.com. And it's got music, so turn your volume down. Now, the interesting thing about this, I show this to head teachers, principals, I think you call them. Show them to superintendents, I show them to politicians, show this to the Scottish Executive, to our elected members of parliament, and this is their reaction. And they're kind of right. And I was saying this one, yeah, it's stupid, and that's why we all loved it, because it was just it was beautiful, wonderful waste of time. And the thing about it is, how much time did they spend doing that? And how much time do they spend learning for you? There's a huge discrepancy. And the other one is the useless part, and I don't think it is. And I don't think it is for this reason. Those cup stacking videos, the first one was viewed by nearly 300,000, the second one by nearly 50,000 people. But that first one, the really quite clever one, the one that you could actually picture in the music classroom, was viewed nearly a million times, but it's this that's interesting me. It had over 8,000 comments and 9,102 ratings. They gave a 4 out of 5. Formative assessment. A go-go. And yet we don't really do this kind of stuff much in class. And this is what happens when you do it in class. And this is a nice look back.
This is
a project inspired by Stephen Heppel. A project that he runs in schools in the UK called Be Very Afraid. The name tells you everything. Because what they do, I want you to look at this. This girl, 16 years old, has come up with a system, a database of her communication over 3 months. IM, SMS, text message, Skype, email, you name it. She puts it in a database, made a little program that then controls this private garden. And every time she sent a piece of information, it quivers. And every time she received it, it sways. Isn't it beautiful? And she's since gone off, she's made a live version of it, which means you can stand with your mobile phone next to it, making text messages, Twittering, Bluetoothing, and make it move for your phone. She's sold that to a modern art museum. Yeah, give her a round of applause for the purpose of a podcast. Now, very small text at the bottom, but a very important question. What was the teacher's role in that? These are all things she's learned. I mean, there's a heck of a lot of learning going on in there. And if you've ever taught databases, spreadsheets, documents, and coding, you know how deadly boring it can be. If you've ever done marketing or seen a business studies teacher, they have great trouble teaching marketing, because more often than not, they've never done it. And craft and design. Well, craft and design projects are normally pointless. The kid is never going to use that coffee table, because they don't have a house with a need for a coffee table. So here they're making something genuinely artistic and actually quite useful, something they can do. So what do we do? When I do reception to ICT, my only concern is whether the communications technology is going to have any kind of impact. And impact does not just mean attainment. And I'm going to ask you to actually forget about attainment, because it's not, surprise, surprise, the most important thing in school, in education. Most of the work I do is on student experience, because the research shows it, but it's also a very strong personal belief that if the student experience is a positive one, the attainment kind of takes care of itself. Now, the other thing that I did, I went to the inspectorate who produced this report, Improving Scottish Education. It's our Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Education who produce these things every year or every couple of years. And in it, the only conclusion you can draw is that emerging technologies, and I stress that word at the top, emerging. So the stuff we're talking about now, you'll come back in 2 years, gone. And it might seem frustrating, but bear with me. Emerging technologies are making the biggest impact. So interactive whiteboards that have been in classrooms for 5 or 6 years are actually beginning to have less of an impact than year 2 or 3. When the teacher had mastered it, had started to really exploit it, but then at some point, teachers and learners get bored of it. But also, just take a look at this. The word count of the document. This year, that's what it's saying. And you could not have imagined that 2 years ago, or 4 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, not at all. CD-ROMs, zero. Yet, so many people still using CD-ROMs in education, thinking that that's a great student experience. So, take a look at the word count. Emerging technologies make the biggest impact because they lead to emerging practices. And there's something about change that makes people better at what they do. The more you change, the better you become at doing different things. It can be different things, or it could be becoming better at the same thing that you were doing before. And having a way to share it all is an area I thought could have an even bigger impact. Because it's all good and well, you doing really well and improving, and you doing really well and improving, but unless you can, if you can share that, then everyone else can take advantage of the changing and the pain and grief that you've gone through. So that was our main aim. reduced very explicitly to something as simple as that. Now, the second point, am I right with my amendments here, the American population here? Is the Fifth Amendment the one about free speech?
No.
The First Amendment. What's the Fifth Amendment?
You don't have to talk. You don't have to incriminate yourself.
Like I say, images, they speak 1,000 words, don't they? That, for me, is what the Fifth Amendment means. That it's this, you know, don't incriminate yourself, so just don't speak. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, standing up here, for example, I'll say stuff you don't agree with. I might well make a fool of myself. It's being podcast, it's going to be out. So, if I were to take the Fifth Amendment, I would just sit down, we'd all sit in silence and have a chat. Taking the Fifth Amendment and the influence of the blog together, it's quite an interesting concept. Go back to these, okay? If you attempt to stop people saying certain things, what happens, do you think? They'll do one of two things. They'll either still say it, they'll just go and do it, and then get themselves into trouble. What do most people do, though? They just shut up. They don't say anything at all. So, the minute you introduce any condition on how people publish and talk about their work, you'll find that most people just won't do it at all. That's why the people who do blog already are kind of like an elite. And the number of people blogging isn't actually going disproportionately up like that. The number of people blogging is flattening out a little bit in education, but everywhere. And it's largely in part to do with the fact that they don't want to incriminate themselves. Was it not in the news this morning on Boston News TV? Students at university, beware, your college could be using your MySpace against you. I heard that when I was getting ready. So what we did, this is a wiki. I'll take you on to it. In case you don't know what a wiki is, it's a web page anyone can edit. We have a support wiki, so that there's only 2.5 of us. So we try and get the other 998 teachers to contribute their knowledge to help other teachers improve. And on this wiki, we put up some policy and guideline support. I'm going to take you to it. That's the page. But the page, I have to say, started out blank. There was nothing on it. And we gave everyone 2 weeks. And in 2 weeks, parents, teachers, let me just go on here. I'll just find it. There we go. They went on, I'll sit down. And they were able to add their thoughts. So this was owned not by the state, not by the local authority, it was owned by the people. Well, this would be typical that it starts to slow down or not respond. You can see the edit page button as well, so you just click that and add your views. There we go. And we had staff guidelines and pupil guidelines. So we're going to the staff guidelines. Can you imagine this is a blank document that actually filled up naturally? And so it's quite long. And we've got best practice. So keep secrets and be mindful of what you say. So if you're in a meeting about budgets that says British Telecom are not going to do X, Y, or Z, then don't blog it, because we'll lose the contract. Be respectful to your colleagues. Get your facts straight. Be interesting. That's the guideline. We don't want boring blogs. We want stuff that's genuinely interesting. Writing or talking is hard work. Let's not add to this by making the reading difficult too. Write what you know. Add value. Don't talk about stuff you're not really confident about talking about. Quality matters. So you work for East Lothian Council, you know, it's got to be good because parents see this. So don't, you know, quality. Provide context to your argument. Engage in private feedback. We want people to respond to comments. We want people to get on the email and keep that communication going. Anyone can take that, copy paste it, put it in your own wiki and get your own colleagues to edit it together and get your administrators. I'll tell you one thing though, we did not go to the Director of Education to ask permission to do this. We did it. And he had as equal a contribution as everyone else to contribute to it, which is really important. If you're in the talk this morning, you know my thing about equality of education. when we talk about kids having equal access to education, we often forget teachers, staff also have equal access. And so that was a really important guiding principle. Third one, touched on it just there, blogs are conversations. So converse. Don't just sit there writing your blog as people take strips out of you or say, this is really good, and then not leave a comment. People go back to see whether you've added a comment. And it's really heart-wrenching when you don't. Got a lovely couple of examples. One of the biggest problems with having 800 bloggers with 660 blogs is the question of who you consult. So, you know, if I'm doing a thing on animation, I know we've got quite a lot of people who are really good at animation, and I know I'm going to step on a lot of toes if I don't involve them in an animation festival. So I can blog it, but I don't know if they read my blog. So there's a big problem with how you consult. And we came up with this, it's kind of a playoff between the Roman army. Any historians here who actually know about the Roman army? Thank God for that. So, the Roman army was built around blocks of 8 men at a time. 8 men who lived in cavernium, it's a tent. They lived in a tent where they ate, slept, did everything together. They got to know each other over the 20, 30 years that they were in the legion. They would form into other groups with other groups of 8 into cohorts, and the cohorts would be led by a centurion who would lead 100 of them or so. It was never actually 100. That's the interesting thing about the centurion. And then the centurions, 10 of them or so, would go and help form the legion. And so you would go on, so forth, so forth. What happened there was that you only needed to know maybe 10 people, normally 8, to be able to get on and communicate and share what you had to do. That's why the Roman army did so damn well, because they had excellent communication. You knew who to consult, because you only had one person to consult, and it went up. It was a bottom-up process, even though Julius Caesar was rather top-down as a manager. Hierarchy is different. If you can picture a hierarchy, take your hierarchy for your school. How many dotted lines sort of begin to appear between the thick ones that are in the official chart? How many unofficial lines come to you, Dean, in your organisation? How many official lines come to a classroom teacher? Lots. If you're really good at animation, then every teacher who wants to do animation will knock on your door. So hierarchy refers to this sort of bundled mess of wires that form a hierarchy, which is what we ended up with, which is incredibly difficult to navigate because there is no clear centurion that you go and speak to. It's all very messy. One way is that our head of education, our director of education, our superintendent, blogs. He's over in Harvard right now in a leadership course. I've managed to avoid him for 4 days, which is not bad. I've picked one post, communicating with parents' community. I learned an important lesson on Wednesday night when I attended a public joint school board and community council meeting in Dunbar to discuss the plans for a new school in the community. It's quite nice that the post is based about a town called Dunbar, because what I'm talking about is the Dunbar number, the number of people with whom you can be friends. No more than 100. 150, I think. It was apparent that members of the community didn't feel they were being properly consulted over the proposals. Even though he's blogged about it the whole time, hurrah, hurrah, people don't read blogs all the time. So he learned this problem. What did I learn? We must improve our communication with parents and communities in as many ways as possible. 9 responses. It's actually quite a heated debate. What I'll do is I'll put the link to it on the blog and you can follow that debate and see what was said. There's actually a whole issue about creating a new school. Big stuff. And he's talking about it very publicly in his blog, and he's getting criticised pretty heavily. He's also written posts like, does a director of education or a superintendent add anything to the education system? And invited comments. Tracking. You've got to keep track of what people are saying about your institution or your expertise or your place of work. So I use Technorati and I keep watch lists. I'm off to New Zealand, so I want to see what anyone's saying about ULearn 07, because if they say something about me, I'd rather know about it. It might be nice, it might not be. I keep a track on Don's blog. Why? Because I'm quite interested to see what people say about him. Around conferences like this, I start to keep watch lists of my favourite bloggers to see who's talking about them, so that I can find out, you know, what are they saying that's interesting, and maybe it's a conversation I want to be part of. Sorry to spook you out, guys. So keeping watch lists about what's going on in your local area, being aware. I think this is the fourth point, can't remember. I heard this on a UK quiz show last week. There was an American person on one panel. She said, "Oh, it's still patronising." And the English contestant next to her said, "It's patronising." So, the one thing about finding a bottom-up culture, about this permissions-based culture, is that when you start to dismantle the permissions-based culture, you can inadvertently become the most patronising innovator you've ever seen. That you start explaining to people what it means to publish. You get it here all the time, people talking about these huge global audiences. We all know that. But it's really difficult to express it without patronising. And I've not got any answers about this, but one example is Facebook. Facebook released the details of its rather closed communities last year. And people on Facebook didn't like that because they hadn't signed up to that. They'd signed up to something private. And do you know what the reaction of Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook? He wrote a blog post where he said, "Yeah, we know stalking's not cool and all, but blah, 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 blah." That's incredibly patronising to your audience. Remember that parents read it, kids read it. We've got to respect each other. Final one. Don't do a Me Too. Don't go and look at East Lothian or any other district and say, "Okay, we'll copy and paste and do it that way." It won't work. The thing about it, that getting on versus getting egg in your face, the idea that looking at your own cultural context, and that's what this morning's first talk was all about, it's about cultural context. Looking at why your culture is not accepting things the way they are often reveals the way through it. I don't believe that America in particular is that against blogging. I think there's something in there. I'd love to stay a week longer to get under the skin and find out what it is. But by looking at the culture in your institution, you will probably find ways through the hierarchy to help people convince. Try and get to the bottom of that. And the way you can do this, of course, is by looking at the implicit and explicit in what it is you want. Are you wanting everyone in your school to blog? Are you wanting everyone in your department to blog? The blog's just one example. Why do you want everyone to do that? I'm going to end with a bit of philosophy. Anyone read Heidegger when they were at university? Yes, it brings back trauma to me. This is from, I studied German and they made me read books in German about things that even people in English translations don't understand. The hammer. Everyone, do you know the hammer example? No? This is I was sitting on the plane over from Iceland coming here reading the end of Dane Whitmerger's book. I nearly started to tremble in the seat as he started going on about Heidegger. The hammer's an interesting one. What's a hammer? You're closest. Sorry, you can pick up. What's a hammer?
The sun? Yeah. Mountains?
That. Okay. Who said the nail word? Did you say nail? Yeah. A hammer is?
With the nail.
Okay, so you need to know about nails to know what a hammer is. What's a nail? Spiky.
Yes.
Yeah. Now you know that nails are good for wood. You know that wood has to come from trees. She's made it to lumber. What do you need to make lumber?
A saw.
Well, you need a factory. What else do you need? You need lumberjacks. If you're ever on Flickr, there's a wonderful group called Lego Vignettes, which has got lots of those. The other thing you need, of course, is trees, which are plants, and you have to understand that these are living things like plants. And then plants are found in forests. What do forests require to survive? They're not just there. They need the earth. It's taken out of a plane. It's quite clever. And the earth, they don't just need earth in the bottom, they need
sun
in the top. So what's a hammer?
A lot of things.
A lot of things. How much of that was explicit when you first thought about what a hammer was? Nails was explicit. So we touched an iceberg. We touched the top of the iceberg. And there was all the stuff underneath that very few people would have followed through. Now, if you're trying to explain why you want so-and-so to start blogging with their class, you've got to get into why they should bother doing that. Hopefully, you're not going to end up with a hammer like that, which is what they might think a hammer is. How public is your public body at the moment? How public could it be? Well, I think you have to actually resist making the implicit too explicit. The minute you try and explain things in the way I've done for the last hour, people begin to fry. Anyone frying? Yeah. People begin to think this is too much like hard work. Anyone thinking this is a bit too much like hard work? Be honest. I would. Don't make it more implicit than it needs to be explicit. I like very social public bodies because also the best part of this conference is not listening to presentations. The best part of this conference is coffee and drinks and duck boats and things like that. It's the social part. And I've had three people or four people come up to me today and say, "Ewan, I'm going to buy you a beer and you're going to show me how to do that thing." And of course, to be honest, a beer is a much nicer way to show you how to do some of this stuff. I want my local authority, I want my public body, my 45 schools, to be social, not anti-social. And that opens doors to a very communicative public body. You start communicating a lot more than you ever have done before. And that, in turn, leads to a very connected public body, which is more relevant to the people in it than it's ever been before. Because I can connect to maths teachers, if I really want to. I can connect to the administrator directly through the comments on her blog. I don't have to go through her PA or her secretary. Very connected public body is an interesting one. Tomorrow on Thursday, session 5, I'm going into how we did it, the strategy we used, and I'm going into some of the classroom antics that we've used to share some of the implicit, because a lot of this is about sharing and holding hands and teaching, and that's what's going to be in Rear Adopted, and that's kind of the final chapter on this. But thank you very much for bearing with me this far. I hope you end up with a very public body. And if you do, and if you want to follow it up, do get in touch. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Go forth and enjoy your coffee.